This is the Humboldt Chronicles.
I am the queen of everything. Gotta be high before I can sway. Light a tea and let it be. If you a viper.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. The Humboldt Chronicles is made possible by Bear Extraction House and Lost Coast Science. And to our sponsors, thank you very much. The truth is, we couldn't do it without you. So, much appreciation. I'm going to avoid the temptation here to call this a show about dirt. Why is that? Because it would be wrong. No less an authority on this than the Soil Science Society of America tells us that dirt is displaced soil that can get under your fingernails after you've been working out in the yard, and it might contain all kinds of inorganic junk. Soil, by contrast, is alive and contains things like worms, insects, bacteria, and other organic nutrients that feed the plants and vegetables that in turn feed us. To be sure, though, soil can be just an inert but clean and healthy medium to support plants. What does all this mean, anyway? It means that soil is important. In fact, there'd be no agriculture as we think about it without healthy soil. So in the next hour, we'll talk soil and agriculture with Michael Beck of Royal Gold Soils and Jill Vanderlinden of Organic Medicinals. We're going to start with Michael Beck. Agriculture, at least as we think of it, has been around for 10 to 12,000 years, which, in the overall scheme of the universe, is like yesterday. So that means we're still learning about best practices when it comes to feeding the plants that feed us and that provide medicine along with fiber and materials for clothing and other products. Here's Michael Beck of Royal Gold Soils in Arcata.
At base level, it supplies support for the plant. It's the base that allows the roots to hold the plant up and create a structure for the plant to grow, right? It goes much further than that in traditional soils and organic soils, where you're looking at biology and nutrient cycling and providing aggregates and minerals and different plant nutrition and different ways for that nutrition to become available for the plant. So it's a very loaded question for our side of the industry, because we provide inert soils as well that have very little biology but no basic plant nutrition, and those are more designed for hydroponic growers to utilize that plant support mechanism style, where it's a grow medium more than a soil. Yet we also have mixes like our basement mix and our Mendo mix and even our King's mix that are designed more like traditional soils, where we're incorporating compost and traditional soil amendments like bat guano and fish bone meal and things like that, that are going to provide nutrition and biology and get those entire life cycles rolling within the soil.
Interestingly, Royal Gold uses, in most of its mixes, a material that was once considered garbage. Here's Michael Beck again.
There's a lot about cocoa fiber. It's waste product from existing industry, and that's a really big sales point for us, is that it was something that was being created, not being utilized, and was a waste product that didn't have a good outlet. It was being dumped in the oceans, it was being burned. All throughout India, there were just piles of this stuff being burned and smoldering, and dumping it in the ocean is not inherently bad, it's just organic matter, but still, it was a product that had a use that wasn't being utilized. Part of the issue with cocoa fiber is that it's naturally high in salts, and it needs to be buffered for those salts to be removed. And that's something that we really have perfected and honed in our time producing the mixes. So we have a better buffering and rinsing process, which makes the product function to its highest potential.
As a producer of soils that can be used to grow virtually anything, Royal Gold markets nationally. And we wondered if, in the national arena, they had gained any insight into the strength of the Humboldt brand when it comes to growing plants.
There is a pretty widespread respect for the Humboldt brand. There's widespread respect for the tradition put into building what's happened here. And there's a camaraderie among people that are using that Humboldt brand. We say made in Humboldt on all of our bags. We're proud of doing the work here in what is a logistical nightmare when you're looking at national marketing. We're proud of the heritage of the people here. We're proud of the way we have changed the perception of cannabis. We're proud of the way we've changed the perceptions of agriculture and organic gardening. You know, going back to the back-to-the-land movements of the 60s and 70s, that's been a hallmark of what happened here. And it is making it out of the area. It is palpable. You go into places and people walk up and they see our sign that says Made in Humboldt, and they're like, oh, Humboldt. So you guys really know what's going on up there? And I'm like, yeah, some of us do. Some of us, you know, we're all learning. We're all a part of it. But it's all about building on the positives of this community and holding each other accountable to do the best things possible and to make sure that we're putting quality product out there, we're putting a quality perspective out there, and that we're trying to help everyone to improve their, you know, niche wherever they're at.
So, if it's true that the name Humboldt does, in fact, contain some marketing glitter, then all the more reason to make sure we get the issue of appellations right. What's an appellation? It's a legally defined and protected geographical identity where, just as an example, grapes are grown for a particular wine.
It definitely affects us if people are using our product, yet then they won't qualify for these appellations and terroir classifications. That affects us in a negative way, even though, you know, people have been growing in these environments and, you know, the sub microclimates with our product for well over a decade now. A lot of times those are very dependent on the native soils, on specifically the mineral contents, and that's why some of the delegations are so tricky, right? Where you're trying to isolate one area as one appellation and another area as another. Proximity to the coast, elevation, soil types all play a role in that. And I can't say that I'm an expert on that, but I can say we support that movement in general. We want people to be able to use those things to qualify their product and to be able to say, hey, no, we're growing in the ground, in the local soils, and that's great for them. But we also want to not preclude the people that are maybe stuck with a contaminated site and want to be able to use that appellation. They're in the right elevation, they're in the right coastal zone, but they're unable to use those native soils due to the history. And we want them to be able to take advantage of those processes too. I'm not sure really what that looks like. The folks over at the Humboldt County Growers Association, I know, have a much tighter feel of that pulse and are a lot more involved in advocating for that. I do believe that one of the primary determining factors is going to be growing in the native soils. And they're going to be amending these soils with worm castings and organic matter, right, of different things. And
just as a matter of course.
Just a matter of course. You absolutely have to alter your nutrient content as your plants consume it, whether that be through permaculture and cover crops and, you know, nitrogen fixing or phosphorus fixing plants and bacteria and fungi. One way or another, you're using either biology or chemistry to alter your soil to produce the plant in the most optimal way that you can. It's very difficult for us to see, oh, hey, you can put earthworm castings that you buy from Southern California in here and that's fine, but if you bring in a soil that's generated right up the street using, you know, aged redwood that we reclaim from the mills that would be going to be burned in the hog fuel plants, you can't use that product, but you can use these other products. That's kind of a gray area that I know is difficult for the regulators and the advocates of these programs to get around.
Appellations are generally determined by the country of origin. In this case, of course, appellations for Humboldt will be determined by local and state entities until federal laws change. And if the federal view of cannabis does change, as seems inevitable, how could that impact a company like Royal Gold?
California has been leading the way. When you look at the California Department of Food and Agriculture, their restrictions on registration of products and labeling are among the hardest in the country to get through, and I see that being the same in the cannabis industry. So they're really going to set the tone for what happens nationally. I think being aware of that is a big part of being ahead of the curve. I think paying attention to the language that's being used by regulators as they start to consider this. I don't know that there's enough trend to really grab anything of meaning from the federal language yet, but I would like to see it coming. You know, you see things happening in the hemp industry that won't be allowed in the cannabis industry, but they're very, very interlocked. There's going to be things that you cannot separate between these two industries. Sure, hemp is, you know, under a certain level of THC, but you got people growing hundreds of acres of it. So when you get down to them processing it down, making isolates of each individual components out of these giant fields, well, yeah, sure, it's under 3% THC or whatever, but you've got acres, so you're ending up with vats of pure THC through your isolates, and you're ending up with vats of pure CBD. So what's to say that there isn't going to be crossover between cannabis type products and hemp type products in the very near future? I think that's a gray area that lawmakers really have to pay a lot of attention to. From our standpoint, we're already supplying soil all over the country, from the bottom of Florida to the top of Maine and everywhere in between. We're working on doing ice road trucking into some people in Alaska. Wow. There's all sorts of really exciting things going on all over the country in the medical and recreational markets. And you see so much traction in the medical markets in places where the recreational market hasn't emerged yet. So these markets are, in essence, going to be created and running before the federal statutes allow them to start interacting with each other, and that's where it's going to get interesting.
Here's a question that almost always comes up when talking about this topic of soil and dirt. Why not just dig a hole in the ground, put the plant in it, water it, feed it, and see what happens?
There are so many variabilities, especially in our area. In Humboldt County, the Appalachian, the soils vary dramatically from Willow Creek to Garberville to Neyland to down on the coast here. You've got places where it's very clay rich. You've got places that are down along the river valley where you've got beautiful mineral rich loams and all of this organic matter that's been washing down the mountains out of the forests and, you know, natural floodplains. So you've got such a diversity of soil conditions, and people are trying to regulate and kind of create systemic balance to how they garden. They want repeatable function, and that's very difficult when you're looking at multiple sites within the same county, especially across a wide area, and you've got historic land abuse, places where the mills have been dumping pesticides, fungicides, all sorts of chemicals into the earth for years and years and years and years, decades. You have places where traditional agriculture is poisoned with pesticides, fungicides, all these same things.
And you wouldn't necessarily know that if you just went and dug a hole.
You wouldn't know it until you try and move your cannabis into testing, which we have the most stringent testing on this crop compared to anything else on the planet. There is no other crop tested to parts per billion or trillion levels like cannabis is being tested. So you can have food that is 10, 20, 50 times more contaminated without batting an eye. But if that level of contamination is in the cannabis, it's not able to go to market, it's being destroyed. So you have people dedicating immense amounts of resources to getting this crop into the ground through the growth cycle, all the way to the testing phase where they should be ready to go to market, and they're failing. And that's amplified even more when you look at extracts, and people are taking that plant, concentrating the materials through the extraction process, volatile, non-volatile, and they're concentrating the contaminants as well. So you may be able to pass through your testing on your flower, but then all of that byproduct goes into extraction and is coming back contaminated, and it's happening all over the state. It's not just endemic to Humboldt County, and in fact, we're better off here than a lot of places than, say, you know, the Salinas Valley down near Santa Barbara, places where there's been much larger scale agriculture for a lot longer because the conditions are right. And those people are having an immensely hard time getting through the testing. And we have farmers that we work with that are like, oh, we're going in the ground, we're just going to amend our native soils, and then they run into these problems and they have to restructure their entire business plan to go above ground, to go into containers, to be able to count on their medium being clean. So we're testing our products at the same level that the cannabis flower needs to be tested. It's our way of looking a little closer, knowing that we're doing right by our clients, and looking and seeing where these contaminants are coming from in the agriculture world, and it's widespread. Things that people are buying, certified organic products off the shelf in their nurseries, are contaminated with pesticides and fungicides because of the way those regulations are built. You can take a non-organic product, compost it down, and it becomes organic through the way the state and OMRI kind of view these things. It doesn't eliminate the contaminants that are in the raw materials going into the composting. So we've had to do complete audits of all of our raw materials, eliminate sourcing, find new sourcing, completely eliminate some materials altogether to find a better way to make clean product.
Does that require constant spot checking?
Constant spot checking, absolutely. We're testing monthly for a lot of these things, more often when we're running through audit processes and things like that, where you're really looking closely at your suppliers and trying to get the suppliers to work with you to commit to providing clean product. And a lot of people that we thought this would be an easy thing to solve are coming back and saying, we just can't guarantee this. It goes so deep down into the supply chain that there's no way to say, I can guarantee this product is going to be clean. So we've had to just eliminate those sources.
Again, that was Michael Beck of Royal Gold Soils in Arcata, and thanks to him for speaking with us. We're going to take a quick break right now, and we'll return with our discussion in a few moments, and next we will try to assess the wisdom of just digging that hole in the ground. Does it depend on the particular piece of land involved, the farmer involved, the plant itself? We'll get some insight from Jill Vanderlinden, and she'll also educate us as to the topic of regenerative farming and dry farming. Before we go to break, though, here's a listing of events you might be interested in. It's our cannabis calendar brought to us by Charleston Tree Service.
Welcome to this month's edition of the Cannabis Calendar, brought to you by the Humboldt Chronicles. The calendar features information on upcoming cannabis-related conferences and events that take place within a day's drive of Humboldt County. The American CBD Expo will take place at the San Jose Convention Center this Friday through Sunday, February 21st through the 23rd. A second expo will be held in Los Angeles, May 1st through the 3rd. Featuring educational seminars and product demonstrations, the expo will include elements covering oils, topicals, beauty, health, and lifestyle products, and even CBD products for your pets. Get more info at AmericanCBDExpo.com. SheCan 2020 will be held Thursday, March 5th at the Haas School of Business on the UC Berkeley campus. Open to everyone, SheCan bills itself as a day of real and honest conversation with industry leaders, allies, investors, and policymakers focused on building a better future for the industry, one in which women and minorities are represented. Find out more at SheCanSummit.com. That's can with two N's. Finally, the Northern California Cannabis Caucus will take place in Sacramento on Tuesday, March 24th. Presented by the National Cannabis Industry Association, the caucus will provide an opportunity for NCIA members and their guests to connect with each other, learn about regional issues from influential guest speakers, and get the latest news about NCIA's federal policy work. Get the details at thecannabisindustry.org. If you'd like to have your event listed on the cannabis calendar, email us the details at studio@humboldtchronicles.com.
Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. If you're just joining us, in the first part of our discussion, we talked with Michael Beck of Royal Gold Soils in Arcata and established the need for healthy, clean soil in the cultivation of cannabis. Now we want to talk about what's already in the ground, in that native soil. With us here in the studio is Jill Vanderlinden. And Jill, first of all, welcome and thanks for spending some time with us. And let's start with some definitions and background. First of all, just tell us what a regenerative farm is and how it works. Do you just dig a hole and put the plant in there and see what happens, or is it a little more complicated than that?
Well, in our area, we're very fortunate that we have these rich, fertile soils. I farm on the floodplain, and Ferndale, Holmes, Pepper, all the way down to Pepperwood, even Garberville can be dry farmed, and the soils are very nice, very rich, very fertile. So, yeah, I mean, you can just dig a hole and plant, and it will grow, and with probably very little problems.
Really?
Really.
See, I put, is it more complicated than that? Because I was ready for you to tell me, well, of course it is. But really, in certain places, right?
Yes.
You can just do that.
Yeah, yeah, definitely.
We know it's a hardy plant,
yes,
and has been for thousands of years. We know that. But what do you mean specifically by regenerative farming?
Well, we regenerate the soil after we plant. We plant cover crops. We do crop rotation. Mm-hmm. We try to create and build more health to our soil. So,
and a cover crop would be what?
Well, we plant various things that produce nitrogen and phosphorus and minerals, and try to, you know, just recreate what was already created and also build upon that.
And dry farming, by definition, is just digging the hole?
Yeah, we do not irrigate. So we don't.
No irrigation.
Once it's planted in the soil, we don't have to water.
Is that because of the floodplain?
Yeah, it is. It makes it a lot easier to dry farm on the floodplain, but it is possible to dry farm in other places as well.
So the plant is that hardy. It can grow without you adding a huge amount of water to it. Because sometimes you'll read in the media that, well, you know, this is going to take a lot of water, all this cannabis cultivation in the state of California. No.
I don't agree, no. I believe that cannabis can grow without a lot of water usage. It's a drought-tolerant plant. Mm-hmm. It's traditionally grown in places where it doesn't, it's not given a lot of water, and it's hot and it's arid, and it does well in those conditions.
Different strains better at that than others, maybe?
No,
just in general.
Yeah, in general.
Do you test the soil before you plant? Because we were listening, you were listening here with us to Michael Beck, and we were talking about what is in the ground.
I think, yeah, Michael. Go ahead. I think, yeah. Definitely you should test the soil. And Michael, that was a very good point he made about the lab testing, and it's very stringent, and you don't want to be surprised. Mm-hmm. After you, it's all said and done, and you've done all that work, and you've gotten your crop, and it goes to the lab, and it tests, and you don't pass. That's a very real issue. And also, the labs themselves, you know, if you do get a fail, I suggest retesting at another lab.
Because, get a second opinion?
Yep. Even the equipment being off, mm-hmm, just a little tiny bit, mm-hmm, can fail you. And, yeah, it's a fine adjustment.
Well, and as you say, you're going to get this information right at the wrong time after you've put in all this work and expense. And then you're at the end, you're going to market, and now you find out that there's a problem. That's exactly the wrong time when you want to know this, right?
That's devastating, yes. It could be devastating, too. Yeah, you can't. It has to all be destroyed.
Yeah.
Or if it doesn't pass, yes.
Right. And so, around here in not just Humboldt, but, you know, pretty much all over this region here, there's been a lot of agriculture over the years. And who knows what's in some of the soil in different places, whether it's runoff or what. How do you advise other farmers before they buy a piece of land? I would think you would want to test it then, right?
Yeah, I would. Yeah.
And what are they looking for?
High heavy metals, lead, mm-hmm, arsenic, cadmium, also all the heavy metals, which will cause you to not pass. And then, you know, other than that, that's mostly what you'd want to look for, is the heavy metals and the pesticides.
A couple of questions, because I'm really fascinated about the dry farming aspect. But first, let us know the name of your farm, if you'd like to.
It's Organic Medicinals.
Okay.
And we're based in Shively.
And it was really interesting to me. That's what first made me want to get in contact with you and have you appear on the show, because I saw something about dry farming. And I had always assumed, and in fact have read many articles about how, oh, well, you know, if cannabis is replacing these other crops, then there's going to be so much more water usage. I'm not asking you to speak for anyone else or get in someone else's mind, but why doesn't everybody dry farm? Is there an advantage to irrigating your crops?
No.
Not that you know?
I mean, no. So, and in some cases on the floodplain, it's a disadvantage. You can get higher instances of mold. You can have IPM problems with infestations. It kind of sometimes will create more problems.
I know Chuck has some questions for you about how you deal with pests, but how about yields? Does dry farming affect the yield?
In my experience, no, it does not affect the yield. No, we get the same yields, I believe, that you would get from watering on the floodplain.
And was this something that did you set out with dry farming in mind, or did you just at some point decide, why are we watering?
Well, traditionally, they have dry farmed the area that I grow in. So it's been an agricultural oasis. It's been dry farmed since its inception, since they cut the redwoods down. So since the late 1800s, they have been dry farming the floodplains of this area. So, I've just taken suit to what's been done before. And it seems like such a great method that that's the way I wanted to farm as well.
I noticed in some of your information it says native soil with biology. What is the biology and where does that come from?
Of course, we're on soil that is rich with the redwoods, millions of years of redwoods. Uh-huh. So it's practically... So, of course, we have that, and then we've got the buildup of all the fish that used to be here. So extremely fertile from all the fish mm-hmm. that used to be here. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of a giant hugo culture where there's redwoods under there. They hold the water. They hold the microorganisms. It's a rich biological environment full of, you know, microorganisms. Mm-hmm. Mycelium, all kinds of holding for water and animals and like bugs, and so it's pretty live. It's a very live situation, mm-hmm. and the fertility of all those millions of years of buildup and the humic profile and all the fish that used to be here and the animals and. Yeah.
It's all in there.
It's there. It's still there.
What about the surrounding land, though, and the surrounding farms and the history of that land and those farms? I assume that that could impact your land or some other farmer who buys a piece of land, and the land itself looks okay, but from somewhere else, contaminants have come in.
Right. Yeah, the railroad and the logging industry mm-hmm. were very harsh to our area. And they used to spray those hills heavily.
Yep.
The railroad also used to spray heavily. Very, very toxic environment. And, yeah, it can run down the hills. And they used to have all the logging and all the, you know, the big mills on the river.
Right.
All that comes down the river.
Yep.
It's a big issue.
How much of a buffer would a farmer need before you would feel comfortable that, I think you've gotten that question before, huh? I can tell.
Yeah, on the floodplain, I don't know. I mean, it's a hard buffer.
But for you, so far so good, right?
I mean, so far so good.
You're passing the test, so that's really all you need to know. But
yeah.
But you see what I'm saying. You could buy a piece of land, and then maybe somebody 5 years later buys other land a little distance from you, but you have no idea what they're putting in the ground.
Right.
And
some of the farms, they have traditionally had some a lot of pesticides put on them. You know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, you would want to know the past history of who used your land, what it was used for, and what they put on it.
Mm-hmm.
Because some things will never leave, like DDT. It's there for...
Who knows?
Yeah. Yeah. Atrazine, you know, some of these things were heavily used in this area. So, yeah, you kind of want to know the history of what it was used for before you got it.
How long do you update your testing if you don't? I know that whatever you grow is tested, but what about just the ground itself? Do you have to update those just for your own?
You don't have to.
You don't have to.
No. But
as long as the end product is testing okay.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. We're SunEarth certified. And we're also CCOF certified.
What does that stand for?
So,
okay.
SunEarth certifies a certification program that is ecologically based, and they use techniques for regenerative farming and carbon neutral and building of the soil. And so to be part of that, they'll come out, they'll test the soil. Mm-hmm. In order to be a part of that program, you have to have your soil tested. CCOF, you know, they will test the water tested. They don't test the soil. So really, it's kind of up to the producer to test the soil.
Gotcha. Who's most likely to buy the end product that you grow? I know that we've been talking about medicinals with you off and on. Tell me, who's your customer?
Well, I sell a lot of product in bulk. Uh-huh. A lot of our product went to bear extraction this year, and it's being processed, currently being processed right now. So the frozen has not went to its end customer yet. It's still being in process. The flour, we sell a lot of it in bulk to Peak Distribution and also to True Humboldt. Mm-hmm. And then Bear Extraction also sold some of our flour. So, yeah.
And what about pests? If you're not putting anything in the ground, how do you control them? What do you do?
Well, once again, we're very lucky in Shively. Our ecosystem here is so diverse and so healthy that we don't, even though we'll have pests, we're not affected by them. So we could have thrips, but we have other bugs that will take them out.
Ah.
So
the ecosystem is helping you out a lot.
Yeah, it's a great synergistic system we got going on.
In promotional material, when we're talking about who your customers are and marketing it to them, does the fact that your product comes from a regenerative farm, from a dry farm, pique their interest or not? Or are they just concerned about whether it tested well? Or is it some of both?
It's some of both. Yeah. Yeah. I think, you know, ecologically minded people will search out farms that have similar philosophies. So that's probably, I think, maybe a lot of our customer base. Because all of the cannabis out there has to pass the test.
Right.
So anything out there that passes the test is, you know. So it's really the philosophical level that people would seek out our product probably more than not.
Do you sense that regenerative farming, dry farming, gives you any or somewhat of a competitive advantage in the marketplace?
Well, financially, yes.
It does?
Oh, yes, because I don't have to, you know.
You don't have the same overhead?
Exactly. I don't have to fertilize, so I don't have to water. I don't have to deal with irrigation.
Yeah.
We don't trellis. We don't stake. We basically plant it in the ground, and then we hula hoe and rototill in between, and, you know, until the end, we don't really do anything. We come back at the end and green leaf and then harvest, and that's that.
So from just a strictly business point of view, your cost of doing business is lower than what it would be in some other location where you had to do more to the land.
Yeah, definitely.
Okay. After a quick break, we're going to continue talking with Jill about her year-round job. It's not just seasonal. And ask about things like restoring habitat, maintaining water quality, preparing land for the next crop, and a whole lot more. You're listening to the Humboldt Chronicles. Welcome back to the Humboldt Chronicles. I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. We're talking soil. And here in the studio with us is Jill Vanderlinden, who has been bringing us up to speed on concepts like regenerative farming. Jill, thanks again for taking the time to talk with us. This is fascinating. I think we're learning a lot here. A few other things to ask you about, though, like protecting that water quality, like in a proactive sense I'm talking about here, and restoring habitat. All of that is mentioned. I saw that on your website, I believe. Talk to us about that just a little bit.
Well, in the winter, we plant a lot of native trees. Mm-hmm. So we try to promote flora and fauna and, like, plant food sources for animals and also people. And then also native plantings on the river itself. So we try to hold the soil, build the soil, and because during the floods, a lot of the soil was taken away on the river banks themselves, and there's a lot of erosion that happened, and it will keep eroding if we don't preserve the banks. So we try to plant trees along the bank and native bushes and shrubs to try to hold that soil there, mm-hmm. so to mm-hmm. prevent the erosion. Other than that, we do lots of pruning of the fruit trees, lots of maintaining of just the other riparian habitat. And,
And are you winning the battle against erosion with your plan so far?
Yeah,
it's still an ongoing battle.
Yeah, it's a very ongoing battle, and there's still a lot of holding to still maintain and to do, because it's pretty bad after the 64 flood.
Still,
just huge chunks of land were just ripped off,
and you're still dealing with that.
Oh yeah. Definitely.
All these years later.
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah. It's gotten a lot better, but still, it's got many, many years to go to build back up. The creek beds are still way too low. They're still cutting, you know, the flooding of the river every year coming up the banks. It still will cut, you know, and the fish being able to get back up the creek, you know. The idea is to build that creek bed up to the point where it's easier for them to get back up there and go back and forth and spawn and do their thing.
Is this common all through the Shively area, as far as you know? That whole area there, the issues you're dealing with there on the land?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah. Anywhere on the Eel River watershed, it's a problem.
Let's go to the end of harvest. So you have... Let's say you have just harvested, and you've gotten your product to the folks it needs to get to. So you're at that stage. What's the first thing you do after that?
We till everything in. So we till up all of the cultivated areas, and then we plant the cover crop.
Okay.
And
so you do till. I mean, I know in some parts of the country there is a concept called no-till.
Right.
But you do till.
Yeah, it's actually a big part of dry farming as far as the way that I've learned to dry farm. The lighter and fluffier you keep the soil, the easier it is to wick the water up and down and to make it more easy for the roots to access it. And it facilitates the flow up and down of the water.
But by tilling, you don't worry about losing some of the topsoil to wind after it's broken up like that? Or does some of that happen just naturally?
It does happen naturally.
Yeah.
But dry mulching is a part of dust mulch, they call it.
Dust mulch?
Yeah, it's part of dry farming. So we have a dust mulch. It will blow away a little. But the riparian habitat all around the farm catches that, you know. So it doesn't go away necessarily.
It relocates.
Yeah, it relocates.
You keep it on your farm somehow, don't you? Well, good for you.
We keep it here in Humboldt. So.
Yeah. You folks in Shively are clever. I also noticed another word that I'd like a definition for. Tell me what bioregional means. I saw that in one of the articles I had read about what you're doing. What bioregional? That's just this whole area, I guess, that we're used to when we talk about this topic. And how you just mentioned that the ecosystem is something that helps you out a lot.
Right.
So how far out does that extend? I mean, how far beyond Shively can the farms go and still do it the way you do it? Do you know?
Well, you mean dry farm?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, you can dry farm supposedly you can dry farm even in the desert. It's all about timing, and it's all about following the watershed down and creating the correct environment to facilitate that movement of water and the movement of roots easily. And, you know, if the fertility is there, the plant will find it. It will use it. But bioregional, you know, our biome, we are ecologically connected, all of Humboldt County, and it's such an amazing, rich biome. Right. And,
Do you have farmers asking you, or other folks who farm in this with the same method, asking you to educate them on this? And one of the reasons I ask is because we talk with a lot of people in this industry for this program, and you know, one of the things that we bump up against a lot is the cost of doing business and the small margins. But it sounds like you have found a way to cut down on the cost of doing business. So I'm curious if you have folks coming to you and saying, how do you do this and how can I do it?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, people have definitely asked us to come to the farm, seeing how we do it, We go to their farms, we show them, we help them plant, we will loan equipment out, we'll go pretty much help anyone that wants to learn how to dry farm. And they can come to our farm also and see how we do it. And there's other farms in the areas that also do it. And the old timers have been dry farming the way that we dry farm since the 40s, 30s at least that I know.
Really? That long?
Oh, yeah.
Are there skeptics out there, though? Are there people, despite your success?
Not in our area, there aren't.
You don't find people arguing with your success?
No, because they can see it in their own neighborhoods.
Yeah.
They can see, you know, that farm has been dry farming and that it's just abundant with fertility and growth and the plants are huge and you can see it with your own eyes.
And so it's not hard to convince when somebody comes out just saying, you know, I think I want to learn a little bit about this. They see it.
Yeah, they see it. It's not hard around here, I think, because it's historically prevalent and prominent. But I have heard of people will contest it in other places.
I was just going to say, around the state, are there people who are just not believers?
Yeah, there are definitely people who are, it's funny you use the word belief, because it is a belief thing. It's not necessarily a real thing. It's a belief thing, because you could be next door to it, and they can see it happening, but somehow they don't believe that they can do it, too.
Right.
I wanted to ask you, I know that in addition to cannabis, you grow many other things on your farm. And I was hoping you could tell us some of the other things that you grow. And do you use the dry farming method with all of your crops?
Yes, we do use the dry farming method with all the crops. Historically, Shively has been known for its sweet corn and its tomatoes, which we grow a lot of both of those. And we grow the lemon cucumbers and winter squash and apples and peaches and pears and plums and walnuts and mulberries, and lots of blackberries. And we do the runner cannellini beans, and beets, and all of our... We try to save our seeds. We've worked with other farmers that came before us in the area that we now grow those seeds, and we've been saving those over the years and regrowing them every year. So all of our seed stock is acclimated to our area, and we also do that with our cannabis. So we will, you know, remake seed every year. We will back cross every year. We will try to create a seed stock that is more honed to our climate and our conditions, and hopefully come up with vitality and something that excels in our area.
And is it a sort of planted on a kind of rotational basis? Obviously, the fruit trees are the fruit trees, and they're there. But do you, like, for example, cannabis in this field for one season, and then beans in that field, and then you rotate them that way?
Yeah, we do rotate. Our farm is large enough that we're lucky to be able to rotate with our cannabis with our produce crops. So, and we've made our cultivation areas large enough that we can basically flip them. So if we have 10,000 square feet of cultivation of cannabis, we have made that area into a 20,000 square feet or even an acre, and we will flip the cannabis with the produce. So because we've created an acre cultivation area, we can move that 10 within that acre. So,
have you noticed that there is any difference in what you flip it to? In other words, when you rotate, do you prefer to have one particular thing go into that plot or not? Or does it matter?
I try to rotate all the crops.
All of them.
So, yeah, so that they'll always be in a new place, and try to create the longest length of time between the planting of that crop in that particular spot.
Gotcha.
So if I can take the cannellini beans and plant them in a different spot over, 6 years.
Okay, then they eventually come back around, it kind of makes a big circle there.
Yeah.
And all of the crops are like that?
Yeah, all the crops are like that. And then we also we use livestock rotation also.
You do?
Uh-huh. So we have American guinea hogs that we also rotate within our system.
Is it just guinea hogs, or do you have other?
Well, we have a cow, but that's just
right.
Our personal cow.
Gotcha.
But, yeah, we do hogs for
you do?
Production.
Cow.
Yeah.
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 I'm curious, I mean, of all the crops that you grow and that you market, is one more difficult? Like, is it more difficult to kind of grow and market cannabis as opposed to beans? Or is it basically the same process?
No, it's basically exactly the same. It's really easy to grow things, really, really easy to farm, tons of stuff. But really, I must say, the hardest part of farming has always been selling it. Like, finding a market for the bounty is the most difficult thing.
And I would imagine that you also have a lot more kind of paperwork and regulations and things to deal with when you're talking about cannabis.
Oh, yes, definitely. Yeah, it's I really had to learn a lot more about computer work. The metric system and just the amount of paperwork it takes to do the permitting and deal with all the agencies all the time. And, you have to report on the water, and you have to renew your permits, and, there's a lot of paperwork
involved. All kinds of record-keeping requirements for cannabis
yes.
that don't exist for tomatoes, for example.
Well, they're a lot more stringent.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wouldn't your life be a lot easier if cannabis were seen as an agricultural crop like all the other ones are?
Yeah, definitely.
Yeah, that goes without saying, huh? what do you think the odds are that's going to happen at some point?
Oh, boy, not
Who knows?
For a long time.
Especially if we leave it up to politicians.
Uh-huh.
Well, Larry, did you learn anything in this last hour? I know I did. I'm curious to hear what's on your mind.
I learned an enormous amount.
Yeah.
I mean, I'm repeating myself to some extent, but the concept of dry farming
yeah.
as being something that anyone can do in any place if they just know the proper technique, that's mm-hmm. new information to me.
Yeah. And I thought one of the things that Jill was saying is that, this is a hardy plant, which we've always heard. I mean, down through history, that's been one of the biggest things about this plant. It virtually grow anywhere, in a ditch. That's why it's called ditchweed, right?
Right.
It just grows without any attention to it. Oh, look at that.
It's true.
Yeah. And it also makes me wonder if in an agricultural a state where agriculture is so important, like California, if if you're educating us to say, you know, this really doesn't use as much water as what you might have heard, if people who are growing things like, I don't know, almond trees that take a lot of water, and we're heading into an era when fresh water is going to, is a, now already, we're there, a huge issue. Could this be something that, that helps agriculture and the water situation at the same time? Wouldn't you think?
I mean,
you see what I'm saying, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, it doesn't require a lot of water, but... But then again, I don't really believe the almonds do either. So,
well,
I don't know.
You tell me. I mean, I read
sweet
at one
corn,
point.
Supposedly sweet corn takes a lot of water also.
But
and
you're saying.
We dry farm sweet corn too.
And you dry. Well, yeah. The reason I'm asking, I've read, you know, in some of our research over the years for this show that it takes a little over a gallon of water for one almond. You don't buy that.
Well, I mean, the methods that they farm almonds, yeah, it does, because that's the way they farm them.
But you're saying that they could do it a different way and save that water.
Possibly they could. I think they... I haven't done the research on it, but I think they probably could.
Well, you're a good ambassador for dry farming and regenerative farming, because we've learned a lot. I agree, Larry. I think this is it's very much an underreported issue, don't you think?
Absolutely. And I also find it attractive because there's a certain sort of philosophical basis underpinning it all. You know, like this is I get the sense that you do this because this is the way that you want to do it because it aligns with your values.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, I farm organically for sure because it aligns with my values, but I also don't really see the point in having to work at something that doesn't need to be worked at. Like, why irrigate if you don't have to irrigate? You know, if you cannot fertilize and you don't have to, then why fertilize? You know, if you can build fertility and not fertilize, then why not build fertility? It's so in the long run, less work is better, and then we can all have the freedom to do other things. A more variety, not to say that work is bad because I love my work, but then I can, you know, have the freedom to do other things besides, you know, something that's not necessary, you know.
That makes sense to me. I get that.
Let me put you on the spot and ask you for a prediction, because I'm one of those people who loves those Shively tomatoes and sweet corn. Give me a good prediction for the 2020 crops. Good?
Oh,
as
yeah.
Always.
Oh, as
all
always.
Right.
Good.
Surprise.
And it's funny about dry farming is that it seems like in drought years, it's almost even better. Yeah. They say that, you know, because you don't water, you get more flavor, more concentrated taste, more, you know, everything's more concentrated.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So,
have we had enough rain this year for you or not?
I don't think we've had enough rain.
No? You needing some more?
I mean, of course, it's going to be fine where I am, but we could always use some more rain, I think.
Okay.
Yeah.
I'm Chuck Rogers with producer Larry Trask. This edition of the Humboldt Chronicles will be posted soon at 941lounge.com, lostcoastoutpost.com, and at iTunes for listening and downloading. Thanks again to our guests, Michael Beck and Jill Vanderlinden. And finally, a huge thank you to our sponsors, Lost Coast Science, Bear Extraction House, and Charleston Tree Service. We'll be back with the Humboldt Chronicles at 6 p.m. on the third Wednesday of each month, which means we'll be seeing you again March the 18th at 6 p.m.